So you brought some other music too, and talk about the other stuff that you brought.
I also brought some Joe Henderson. Talk about lyrical, you know. And I was trying to actually decide what was I going to bring down, you know. And I thought, let me bring this recording of Chelsea Bridge, you know, the Billy Strayhorn. So, but yeah, I brought that recording. I think it has Lou Hayes on drums. I think Kenny Barron's on piano on that track. But if you listen for Joe's, well, you don't even have to listen for it. It comes to you, you know. his lyricism and his vocal sound, you know, the way that he phrased. I mean, I read an interview with him recently. I think it was actually on the internet that I saw, about how he always just wanted to be a lyrical player, you know, that a player of ballads, you know. And it was interesting, insightful to read this his commentary on himself, mm-hmm. saying, you know, when he plays fast, or when he listens to himself back playing fast numbers, that it sounds kind of confused to him, you know, or not relaxed. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, we all listen to it and say it sounds incredible.
It sounds incredible.
You know, and incredibly relaxed. You know, but I think that, you know, it's those things that often we think. But we work on, you know, and we think, I'm just not quite getting there, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not quite making it, you know. Those are the things we focus on, and it improves, you mm-hmm. know. And he certainly, obviously, put a lot of energy into his sound and that lyricism that he thought was lacking.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So. I had the opportunity to work with Joe a few times. He actually played on my first recording for at the time it was a small Japanese label that I had done my first or second recording as a sideman for, and then they had asked me to return and do a record and asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I want to get Joe Henderson. You know, I remember I was living with Bill Stewart at the time, and I came home one evening, and he said, Joe called. And I said, Joe who? He said, Joe Henderson. I said, come on, man, don't do that. Don't lie to me. But I checked the machine, and I heard, you know, right, this is Joe. I don't know if you're in town or out of town. He had a certain thing that he would say, you know, and he's sort of a character. And the next thing I knew, you know, I was on an airplane flying to San Diego to play with Joe Henderson. And I said, this can't be happening. You know, it's just incredible, you know.
You also brought some other stuff in. Glenn Gould, right?
Mm. Yeah. This is a recording of Glenn playing the Berg Sonata, Alban Berg. I've been listening to him a little bit again recently and being stunned again, you know, at the...
Are you stunned in a different way?
Well, I think it just deepens, you know, you just mm-hmm. realize the control at the instrument, the musicality, the, you know, for all his, for all the perhaps accusations of him being calculated and cold or something like that. And, you know, I hear such a romantic, you know what I mean? Just the kind of music making, a kind of attention that is, to me, fairly mind-blowing. And, you know, and I aspire to that kind of attention, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not easy.
Now, you've put out at least 10 albums. Is that right?
I think so. I think actually I have another record coming out in within a few weeks. So I think it's actually 12 records.
Okay.
Yeah, 12 CDs.
Well, tell me a little bit about this latest one that's coming out.
Unfortunately, I didn't have a copy to bring down to the station today, but it's actually my first recording of standards. And it's for a small Italian label that's just starting up. It was started by a booking agent, actually, that mm-hmm. I worked for in Italy. And the title of the album is For Heaven's Sake. I don't necessarily like to mix politics with music, but I will. And it just seemed, I don't know, appropriate title. And it's one of the songs on the record. And but it's all standards, and because I love playing standards.
Mm-hmm.
And
who's on there with you?
It's my regular trio that I work with. I've worked with for a number of years. Bassist Doug Weiss, who's from Chicago originally, went to William Patterson, New Jersey. I met in New York, probably around the same time that I met the drummer in the band in my trio, which is Bill Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they've been with me for a long time.
Great. So tell me also about, I guess, now I'm kind of going a little bit backwards, but maybe we can start at the beginning and move forward. What about the different sounds? I mean, as you look back on the 12 albums that you've had, is there a pattern or a progression that you can see? And what is that?
Well, I think in my earlier records, you know, you would probably hear more of my direct influences, I'm not sure I'm in a position necessarily to analyze the progression artistically, but, you know, they're just sort of markers, you know, in my creative life as a composer and as a pianist, you know.
You also mentioned that there were certain phases that you went through in mm-hmm. your life, and are those albums reflective of that, or?
Probably so. I mean, let's see. Well, my first record was a quintet record that was, like I said, with Joe Henderson. And at that time, I was living, I was a roommate of Bill Stewart. So we were playing together a lot and listening to a lot of the same music. And so perhaps that period of my life was, you know, probably influenced by those surroundings, you know, and Sunset Park, Brooklyn, and the music that both Bill and I were checking out and stuff he was hipping me to and stuff I was hipping him to. Andrew Hill records that I wasn't aware of, you know, like Black Fire with Roy Haynes and Joe and, of course, Andrew Hill. And that's sort of on the fringe of losing it, freedom, mm-hmm. you know. And then I guess after that, doing a few records for the Danish label Steeplechase, I'd begun to work with Eddie Henderson in the early 90s. So I called Eddie for that. One of my favorite drummers, Joe Chambers, you know, who I was hearing on those Blue Note records, mm-hmm. you know, with Wayne. And again, I, you know, on some level, it's funny, you know, it's like this idea of controlled freedom, I guess, is a thread that runs through it. Through my records. Though I feel like maybe my recording career took a little dip when I did the Steeplechase records.
Oh, really?
Well, on some, you know, maybe when I listen back to them, you know, I think, oh, well, they're okay in a certain way.
You're not as happy with those.
Maybe not. You know, I mean, that quintet record was, I think, came out pretty well. You know, but I didn't like the sound on them particularly. The studio wasn't all that great. But when I signed with Blue Note, I felt a bit more focused, I think, musically, and a little more confident in what I wanted to do, and assembling the band that I did at the time, my first record. Interestingly, at first it was a whole different band, and then I was having trouble getting the rehearsals together, so I just scrapped it and mm-hmm. went with guys that I thought maybe I needed to record with, you know, at that time anyway, and I'm, you know, quite happy with the results. In fact, I brought one of those tracks with me for historical purposes.
And which one is that?
That was my first, from my first record, Seventh Sense on Blue Note, with Steve Nelson on vibes and Seamus Blake on saxophone, who I had met recently, and Brian Blade on drums. And so I guess that was about 1993. And Doug Weiss again on bass.
So what do you remember about where you were at that point?
With Blue Note?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had met Bruce Lundvall, the president of Blue Note, at a jazz festival in Japan, the Mount Fuji Jazz Festival, which was a Blue Note festival, largely.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there playing with Bob Belden, the composer and big band arranger,
mm-hmm.
saxophonist. He had put a band together of the New York guys, and Joshua Redman was there, and I think around that time I had just started playing with Josh and his band. And you know, I remember just having a brief conversation, being introduced to Bruce, and it's him saying, you know, if you ever have any music you want to send up our way, you know, please do so. So, you know, I set out to put a little demo together, and I met with them, and so that was very exciting.
Cool.
You know.
And what about where you were? I guess, how are you feeling about where you were in your career or where you were musically?
I just wanted to keep playing and keep writing and trying to, you know, grow as a musician and as a piano player. And I think at that time I was really interested in creating different textures, both compositionally and you know, in instrumentally. And I think that's why that record worked out, you know, that way, because I was thinking about that. Also, Schofield produced that first record for me.
John Schofield.
Yeah, yes. who I had never met, although Bill, I believe Bill had, Bill Stewart, though he's not on that first record, had, you know, started playing with Sco in during those days, and I may have even gotten his number from him. I don't know.
Okay.
But so it was really cool to have him there too, and he had some great suggestions on, you know, music.
So when someone, for the layperson who really doesn't know how a record is put together, when you call somebody like John Schofield and you say, I got these compositions, and I want you to produce the record for me. What does that mean? What does he do when he comes into the studio with you?
Well, to be honest, his main contribution probably was less spoken than the presence. You know what I mean? And just, you know, it's important to have a second set of ears, you know? Though... I mean, I've produced my own records as well. It's not to say it can't be done, but especially if the instrumentation gets larger, you know, which it was with that thing, and it was a little unique. And
so the producer comes in, they're a second set of ears.
A very, very good second set of ears. And basically, you run the tracks down, and he says, well, what do you think about that? And you know, he was very relaxed. He's a great guy and just very chill. And
is there a certain sound that he brings, a sensibility that he brings
to
it or something?
Maybe. I'm not sure. You know, I mean, I basically had a pretty clear idea about what I wanted, you know. But there were moments where, like, for instance, on that track, there's a thing at the end of the tune. I'm not even sure originally how I had planned to end it, if I had a plan at all, but maybe some kind of vamp out, you know. But we wound up doing this sort of strange, ethereal sort of sounding thing, just rehearsing, messing around, and John got on the talkback mic and said, hey, you should do that. You
know? Okay.
Do that at the end of the tune, you know, when it's going out. And so... you hear that at the end, and that was John's suggestion.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. So do you, when you go into a studio, do you go in, I know you go in with compositions, but do you really kind of have a fully coalesced idea? I would suspect, as a jazz musician, you probably are thinking, well, I've got this guy, and I've got this guy, I've got this person, whatever, and I know for the most part what they're going to bring, because I know what their sensibilities are, but and how they're going to maybe interpret my music, but how coalesced is the idea when you go into the studio?
Well, I like to leave it fairly open. I mean, it's a funny dichotomy or something, you know, where you want to leave the musicians enough freedom to do what they do best, you know, because that's the way the magic happens, you know. I've never been very into controlling what, you know, the guys do to somehow realize my vision. I mean, I'm more of an improviser, you know, than probably anything, you know, above anything. I love that process, you know. And so at heart, that's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
And so the surprise element is really valuable to me, and I know that that's where the magic happens. You know,
have you ever been so surprised that you kind of had to say, "Wait, stop"? That's really not the where it's going to go. And like,
oh, surprise in a bad way.
Yeah, has that ever happened?
I try not to do that. First of all, you know,
it's educated because of a choice, maybe.
I mean, if there's something really wrong or there's a big mistake, then you stop a take. But other than that, you know, tape isn't that expensive. And now, you know, hard drive space. I mean,
yeah, right.
You know, so it's generally inadvisable to stop a take. Just play it out. Unless, you know, like I said, unless you really have a strong feeling about it. Because it's very hard to... I mean, if the habit was to stop takes, if it was recommended, you know, for good record making, you know, most of the records that we love would never exist because, okay. You know, there would be, you know, someone would make a mistake. And I mean, there's mistakes all over the place, right. on our favorite records. You know, one could say in a certain way that it's kind of endearing, but a lot of times we don't even notice them. Or what was conceived, even we don't even know how the musician was feeling at the time when he was doing it. He might have thought it was horrible. And
turns out to be genius.
And it turns out, you know, it had the thing, which, you know, perfection in jazz is a tricky matter. You know, what is that? You know, a perfect improvisation, you know, a perfect, you know, because it's always kind of this stumbling along in a certain way, you know. Just some people stumble a lot more artfully than others.
Stumbling with finesse.
Exactly. You know, it's like one big stumble fest, you know, in a lot of ways. And that's, you know, a funny thing.
And I mean, trying not to step on each other's feet at the same time.
I guess, yeah, you know. But then if that happens, you know, you do a little dance and you say, I meant that, you know.
Right.
And that's kind of the way it goes. And that's those of us who are fortunate to play this music, you know, really cherish that part of it, you know, and it's really a unique thing, you know, unique process.
Truly.